GQ's Mad Influence is presented by Moët & Chandon. Life's memorable moments must be Moët & Chandon.
So this is a podcast about what I've been calling the long arc of creativity, exploring the work of some of our best actors, directors, writers, artists, and musicians with long, productive, ever-changing careers, about how incredibly rare that is, how hard it is to pull it off, how to pull it off. I wanted to be sure to include, and I'm honored to have with us today, a fashion designer I respect greatly, and from whom I think there's a lot we can learn about creative breakthroughs and the long-haul process of living an artful life.
Very good. Sorry, I'm so late. Hi.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Paul Smith is one of the most consistently inventive designers in the fashion world, and one of the most enduring. He's been in the fashion business for almost 50 years, and somehow seems younger in spirit than when he started. You'll recognize his work, even if you don't know it by name. His menswear, especially. Bold patterns, shocks of vibrant color, and his signature technicolored stripes. That's the Paul Smith look and its spirit, somewhere between a rainbow and a pop art hallucination. He's branched out not just into women's wear, but into dozens of fields and collaborations. Luggage, rugs, lighting, bicycles, water bottles, cameras, even a Mini Cooper. All of it touched by the color wheel of his imagination. His shops in London, Tokyo, New York, all over the place, were early embracers of the eclectic, selling not just suits, but cool gadgets, objects, books, the first Dyson vacuum cleaners, prefiguring the modern sensibility that holds that design, art, fashion, and architecture not only live under the same aesthetic roof, but speak to one another. His unabashedly pink flagship store on Melrose in Los Angeles is said to be one of the most Instagram buildings in the world. He's been knighted by Queen Elizabeth, but nowhere in business will you find a less pretentious man than Sir Paul Smith. And nowhere will you find a more energetic, restless, creative soul. When he comes bounding out after his runway shows, I often think he has more energy than most wan 20-something male models. Paul Smith, thank you for joining us here in the world of Mad Influence.
Wow, I won't be able to get out of the room. My head will be so wide, you know. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
I think that's it. I can go now.
You can go now.
Yeah. See you. Bye.
So, look, I want to go back first. I want to start with how you broke into the fashion world, because you really fell into it accidentally, right?
Yeah.
And so your first field of interest was bicycling. You wanted to be a professional bicyclist.
Yeah.
You were quite serious about it. And then you had a horrific accident.
That's true, yeah.
What do you remember of that day?
Age 12 to 18, I was a bike rider.
Okay.
And, you know, foolishly, I thought I could be a professional. I never would have made it because I wasn't brave enough or good enough. But hey, you know, dreams.
Right.
And then I literally fell into fashion after a car and I met. The car won. So I was in hospital for 3 months.
Yeah.
So, I mean, then a couple of the guys that were in the hospital at the same time as me, one had had a motorbike accident, one had had a car accident. And we were all locked into our beds with traction and all sorts of things. And we used to, you know, call at each other across the ward. And we all got let out at the same time. It's
really?
Like prison. Now, we all were released from hospital at the same time. So one of them said, oh, why don't we just meet up and keep in touch? And luckily for me, one of the guys chose a pub in my hometown where the art students went. And slowly meeting a few times, talking to other people in the pub, and I'd be like talking to you, and you say, oh, what do you do? I'm an architecture student. Oh, I'm a fashion student. Oh, I'm a graphic design student. And then this world opened up to me.
But it's interesting because immediately from that first time when you encountered that world, it's eclectic. It's designers, artists, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, in hindsight, my father had a really lovely personality and was very charismatic, and so hopefully I inherited a bit of his communication skills. Yeah. And then he was an amateur photographer, so from the age of 11 he bought me a camera, so I started taking photographs. And it was quite interesting in those days. You know, when we take pictures now, it's normally with our iPhone, and you just take 20 pictures and delete 19.
Right.
But then when it was with film, and you were looking through this tiny viewfinder, they called it, mm-hmm. and you had to really set up the picture, you know, with your eyes. And that really taught me to look and see and to really understand about what I was looking at.
Were you drawn into the, this is the late 60s, early 70s, were you drawn into the like swinging London Carnaby Street scene at all?
Oh yes, I was very much part of that whole London scene and amazing clubs and gigs. And you know, I saw Patti Smith when she first came to England in 72, and The Doors and Pink Floyd. And then when I was about 18 or 19, I made a pair of trousers for Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin.
Was that a breakthrough for you?
It was good because he was only 24-inch waist, so I hardly used any fabrics. That was really good.
So I wanted to know first about when you did, you opened up a shop in your town, like 1970, which is just like hard to picture. You're all of like 24, I think?
Yeah, 24, yeah.
And a bit of a dandy?
Very much so, yeah. Long hair and velvet jacket, flowery shirts, you know. The wonderful thing about England at that point, around 66 to 70, was self-expression through how you looked.
Yeah.
In 68 in Paris was the Paris riots with the students, and that was very physical, very anger and burning cars and manifestations. So their self-expression came through
kind of rage.
Sort of just, you know, doing more brutal things. Whereas in England, you know, we were just dressing silly. And it was self-expression through, you know, just looking differently. And I think that was a really creative time.
So you started, you and Pauline started designing your own clothes right away?
Yeah, because she studied couture fashion. So that's really how to make clothes and the importance of making them beautifully. And then my wife, she then taught me literally at home how to cut patterns, and we had a machine at home and how to make things. And
I mean, that's the original DIY.
Yeah, it really was. And I used to work doing lots of freelance jobs. I could take photographs, so I worked for magazines like The Face and Arena as a photographer. I worked as a stylist. I worked as freelance designers for an Italian company. So all that was really learning my trade, really. But the fantastic things was you could see a really good band that went on to be enormous bands above a pub or in a very small venue. So, I mean, I saw Zeppelin, you know, just in a small, you know, pub in North London, and the Stones. And
how did you come to know Bowie?
Well, from the age of 18, I used to go to bands. I used to go to from Nottingham to London every Friday, and so you afterwards, you know, I'd learnt to silkscreen print, and I used to print a few T-shirts. I'd have them in my bag, and so I'd go to the gigs, and then if I was lucky, I could meet the band afterwards, because there was no changing room. So the band just stopped, and then they would just get in their van and go. Right. So I'd go up and say, oh, I really like the new album. It's so good, like this. And occasionally, they would say, what do you do? And I'd go, I'm a designer. Do you want to buy a T-shirt?
So basically, you're selling merch? Paul Smith selling merch to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. And so people like Eric Clapton, Jimmy, and Rod Stewart in those early days when he was really amazing, and Long John Baldry, which was the name of the band he sang for. And then eventually I worked for this company in London that made clothes for rock stars. And so I got to know a lot more of the rock stars then. And then eventually I opened my London shop in 79. And then one day my little studio was upstairs, and one day there was a phone call saying that it's a bit chaotic outside because David Bowie's just come in, and there were about 600 fans had seen him come in, and I went down to say hello, and eventually we just became friends. I invited him up to my room, which I think you've been to, my crazy room with all books and objects.
I want to talk about that crazy room.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to take a quick break here to thank Moët & Chandon. And luckily there's some great synchronicity here, because Mad Influence features the personalities and performers who shape our culture, focusing on moments that have mattered most to them. We explore the artistic breakthroughs, the hard-won discoveries that have helped forge legacies and define careers. The stuff, in other words, that's worth celebrating.
So it's fitting that this season of Mad Influence is presented by Moët et Chandon, who has stood for celebrations for over 275 years. As we examine the ingredients of some pretty unforgettable creative careers, we're grateful for the support of the world's most loved champagne and for their encouragement to usher in the holiday season by celebrating life's memorable moments. That's what I want to ask actually about the sort of ambitions of your aesthetic, because I do, when I look back at it, I could see that you did have an influence, an early influence, in sort of feminizing what one would think of as menswear.
Definitely.
Floral, yeah, I mean, prints and things like that I think in a lot of ways men are just now coming around to. Did you see it?
I mean, in 67, well, when I, my first shot, that was 1970, but in what was interesting about those 60s is that really a lot of men were really finding themselves for the first time, because in London especially, it was, in the north of England especially, it was considered really feminine if you even cared how you looked.
Yeah.
You know, if you did touch your hair, you know, everybody was like, what are you doing? You know, you had to be a lot more masculine, because a lot of the trades were coal mining and things like
right.
that. And so eventually, when after the horror of war, second generation after the war, suddenly people started to be able to just be more self-expressive. You know, they could just do their own thing a bit. Graphic design, music, of course, the Stones in 62 with long hair, the Beatles. And then there was a whole dandy sect in London. And they were mostly really upper-class guys. And they were making things out of their grandma's curtains, like velvet curtains, and they'd make a jacket, or they'd make a shirt out of some dress material or something like that. So it was, as you say, it was just a really big change. And then obviously Mick Jagger in Performance a lot later, you know, the movie. And
you mean blurring the lines between gender?
Correct, yeah. I mean, yes, I mean, myself, I, you know, did have a very feminine look at the time, you know, scarves and flowery shirt, long hair, tight trousers, you know.
When did you start doing the kind of like hidden secrets that are always in your clothes, just like linings with just, you know, it looks sometimes like a traditional suit and then you look inside and there's a go-go girl inside, yeah. or bright pink or something.
Yeah,
like
that. That was when I started designing the clothes myself in the early 80s. When Pauline was designing the first two or three, Paul Smith collection was designed by my missus, you know, by Pauline. Yeah. And then she decided she wanted to pursue her love of art. So she went on to study art and then
became
paint.
A painter, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so then I suddenly had got the collections to design, and I felt a bit insecure. So I used to just do quite classical clothes, but always with this little secret. So a coloured buttonhole, two buttons, both different, coloured lining. And then obviously things like socks that you could wear in, you know, unusual stripes or something like that.
The famous Paul Smith socks, which are the boldest thing still in the market.
And yeah, I mean, and we pioneered that.
Yeah,
you know, because he's quite in then. It's so different now. But then most guys still had to wear suits every day, classical suits. So the only way you could really have any self-expression was socks, cufflinks, or ties.
Yeah,
and that was it. You know,
I notice this in London now. It's still to this day. It's a lot more suited than it is in New York or L.A. or anywhere else.
Thank goodness.
Yes, someone's holding up the torch.
Yeah,
London.
Yeah.
No, but also I think there's something about the way that you kind of fixated on these small details that someone had to notice and feel a kind of pride of authorship.
Yeah, it was like a secret, really.
Yeah.
I wanted these secrets. I like the idea, because at the time, I might have my dates all wrong now, but obviously there was Vivienne and Malcolm McLaren. There was, you know, the I think one shop was called Sex, and the other one was called Too Young to Too Fast to Live. Anyway,
Too Fast to Die, or
whatever. Yeah, and then there was Gautier, and there was, you know, there was a lot of a very, very extreme fashion.
Right.
And I've never been a very confrontational person. So, you know, I wanted my clothes to be not look at me clothes. I wanted them to be very acceptable. but also have a little secret. And that, in fact, that was one of the reasons why in Paris, we showed in Paris right from the beginning, because there wasn't a fashion week in London. So the only place to show was Paris. There was no Milan, no Florence, no New York shows then. The French embraced it really immediately, because they just thought, I can wear this, but it's got this fantastic little secret hiding in it.
I was watching footage of your first show. It looks like it still speaks to the current energy of your shows. There's sort of some rock and roll aesthetic to it.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And can you, were you nervous when you first did it? Do you remember that first show?
Well, the very, very first show was in a friend's apartment in Rue de Vaugirard in Paris on the second floor. So you can imagine all the, like, people from Barney's and everybody, they had to ring the doorbell to come in to a fashion show because it was in a flat, you know, it was in an apartment.
Yeah.
And I think we had about 35 people in the audience and about... all the models were friends, and the dresses, we did it all ourselves, you know. And yes, of course, it was really exciting and really nerve-wracking. We all burst into tears because we were so full of nervousness and excitement at the same time.
I just can't imagine what the fashion world now a fashion show is so highly produced. They're often live streamed. I think they're often less fun.
I think if anybody dare do it again, a show in an apartment or a little showing with 20 people or 30 people would be such a breath of fresh air for people now.
Do you think sometimes, what are fashion shows for?
Oh, absolutely, all the time. I mean, because they, as you know more than anybody, is that you guys in this building where we are now, you have to go to like 100 or in all the different cities. And sometimes you just think, has anybody noticed, you know, what we've done in the last 6 months? Because you have to see so many, and often the shows are quite short, intentionally, you know, so you can get the point across really quickly.
You always say to your models before they run out, remember to be silly. Try and be silly. And what is, are you just trying to, like, cut through the abject seriousness of the fashion world?
Well, also, I just sometimes just say, well, you know, it's okay to smile. Or it's okay. Walk like you're walking down the street, you know, especially with girls, because they will often look like they're horses, you know, because they walk with this sort of one foot in front of the other, and it's this sort of very regimented way. And so you just want them to relax, not really silly, but relax, you know. And, but they never do. As soon as they get out on the catwalk, they immediately
smile.
They immediately become soldiers again, you know.
Well, in the most basic sense, then, what is a fashion show for nowadays? Is it marketing? Is it what does it do for you?
I mean, the theory of it is that you have 12 minutes, a very large amount of money, and on one side of the catwalk are buyers, and on the other side are press. And so the buyers are looking for new ideas, but they also got to pay the rent. And the press are looking for new ideas to fill a page and directional shapes. And it used to be slim, 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 and now it's baggy, baggy, baggy. Or it used to be black and white, now it's color. Then it used to be bright color, now it's pastel. And, you know, that's all these messages that you hope you're getting across. And then, of course, then you get the video, which then all your shops around the world can see, and then your fans on social media can see. And so it's still, they still have a value, shows. It's just that they're just different to what they used to be. And I mean, I was blessed with going with Pauline to couture fashion shows when I was 21 in Paris, where you would go to a Yves Saint Laurent show. I saw the first time Yves Saint Laurent showed the smoking, the famous smoking. Yeah. And there was like 18 people in the audience, 20 people in the audience. Balmain, Patou, Balenciaga, Cardin, Chanel. I went to all those shows when I was 21, 22. We used to buy tickets from the Chambre Syndicale, which is the organization that organizes all those shows. And then you would go to the salon of the designer, which was in a what they call an hotel particular. It's like a beautiful old building. And they would have one or two little fashion shows a day for 2 weeks. And there was no music. the model came out with a card with a number on it. You had a list on your chair, and it was said, oh, black taffeta, ball gown, or with handmade pearls or something. And so, and there were, there'd probably be 15 outfits maximum, 18. And in the audience, it would be the most unbelievable thing, because there'd be like six students, which I got in as a student, and then there'd be, this is true, two nuns.
Two nuns?
Yeah, because in France,
fashion-loving nuns,
or the young girls that were at the convent, they were taken to the couture shows because that was seen as a very fantastic career. So there'd be two nuns, some girls, there'd be Babe Paley, you know, yeah, people like yes. that on the front row, like yeah. American socialite, one pop star, and I use the word pop intentionally. You know?
Yeah, and that's I want to ask you about the beginning of the of inspiration. You have a book that I love called You Can Find Inspiration in Everything, and in which you chronicle the act of unusual inspiration.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us some of the strangest or most unexpected things you've been inspired by and that have led directly to design and clothing, and how did you find them?
I mean, a lot of the things are go back to what I said earlier, where, you know, you're taking photographs through a viewfinder,
right.
And then that really teaches you to look. So it could be to do with texture, so it could be to do with a rough wall and a shiny door, so that could be Harris tweed and silk. Mm-hmm. It could be graffiti, it could be a Matisse painting, it could be a movie, very rarely a movie in my case. Often it's an artist. So we've just done a collection that's based on this man called John Craxton, who was a painter, very unknown painter. But when he painted down the edge of the person, he would put a strong line down the side of the when he was painting a person. And so we've done knitwear that is basically navy blue, but with a strong line down the side seam
yeah.
or down the sleeve, literally based on his paintings. So it's all there if you want it. And the problem with the industry, as you very well know, is that everybody's chasing everybody's tails these days. They're all looking at, oh, what's this brand doing? What's that brand doing? Oh, we should be doing this. Oh, this is on trend. And it's absolute nonsense to think that you have to follow the whole time. You have to know what other people are doing, but you know, you can be yourself. And providing you understand that it's gone bigger shapes and that's your emphasis, but you can take your influence from anything, really.
Well, you did say in a documentary, you said that you sometimes feel like you should be trendier or more fashion-oriented and that you don't get quite the respect from the big fashion magazines because of that. Is that a problem?
Only a personal, emotional problem. You know, the fact that you work very hard. I've had a very successful business for 50 years. We've never gone backwards. We're still independent as a company. We've not been eaten by one of the big guys, which, as you know, even recently, yeah. Several designers have been, you know, sold.
Yeah, God bless you for that, though, for staying independent. I think that's
yeah. Well,
cool.
I mean,
and rare. Very
yeah,
rare.
Very rare and quite challenging, obviously, yeah. in the world where people spend very large amounts of money on promotion of something, and you don't have that very large amount of money.
Back to inspiration for a second, because you told me once about how you think everybody, this was even before the iPhone fever, but you were like, people don't look up enough.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was so funny because afterwards it became really true that no one looks up enough. But you, I think you'd been to India, you'd been traveling, and you were
Vietnam.
Yeah. Okay, and you were talking about how you just there was just a riot of color and inspiration everywhere.
Well, the thing
you turned.
Is, you know, I had the strong connection with France, and then a lot of the architecture is really amazing with an Art Deco influence sometimes. So if you walk along a street in Hanoi, you look up, the architecture is fantastic. You look on the ground floor, it's this absolutely mad plastic fronted fruit shop or souvenir shop, and it's hideous and kitsch.
Yeah.
But I mean, that goes back to influence again. So you could have the most beautiful cashmere suit in navy blue, but with a really kitsch shirt.
Yeah.
So, you know, like a Hawaiian shirt and some tennis shoes. So again, that could be it could be an influence by just observing something really bad taste with something beautiful, you know.
Well, there's a moment in that documentary where you like go to some arcade or some it's like a carnival, and you're just like, there's so many shirts.
Yeah.
There's so many designs here.
Yeah.
And it's a little kitschy, right?
Yeah. Well, I've always loved kitsch in moderation, you know, yeah. where you can just put, I mean, we work a lot on the word irreverence, you know.
Right.
So just putting things that together that you shouldn't really put together, you know. And my there's a suit of mine in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London from 82, and it's a pinstripe classic fabric, you know, like the financiers used to wear in London mm-hmm. in the 60s and 50s. But it's this huge shape, you know, a bit like the crazy suit that David Byrne wore
yeah.
in Talking Heads. Not as extreme as that.
But outside.
But really outside.
Yeah.
But with a white T-shirt and a pair of tennis shoes. Nowadays you say, so what? But in 82, it was really interesting and different because it was a classic fabric, but in a big shape, and then worn with tennis shoes and a white T-shirt. So it's always playing with opposites, and I just wish people would have more self-expression, and they don't because they're too nervous about peer pressure and what people think of them, you know. So they're a lot less adventurous as they should be, maybe.
You've mentioned in the book you can find inspiration in everything, that you present some of these ideas in the hopes that younger designers will move away from what you call the disease of copying. What do you mean by that, and how does it manifest itself?
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is that the world is moving so fast, and there's such a need to take money, especially if you're working for a company that's publicly quoted on the stock market.
Right.
So the shareholders are always like, more, 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 we need more, yeah. we need profit. So often you just turn to the lowest common denominator. You know, you just go, like, for instance, logo at the moment. Everything's, you know, you spend a lot of money on promotion, you get a celebrity designer, you have a fashion show somewhere in the world, which is probably quite extreme, and then you put the name, it's almost becomes like a mantra, you know, it's like, right. you know, the name over and over and over and over and over. And it's just a cop-out, really. It's just a fast buck, you know, but I totally understand why people do it. It's just a bit disappointing, really. So you just would hope that when the young designers would just try to be a bit more creative in their own right.
Bolder.
You know?
Bolder, too. I always think that designers have the most, and I'm talking about high fashion, you know, big house designers have the most stressful creative careers of all, because they have to produce something, you know, that's supposedly artful and commercial again and again and again, and as soon as they do, they're
asked to
do more.
I mean, we've seen, sadly, how many people have fallen by the wayside. You know, we've seen poor old Lee McQueen.
Yeah.
You know, took his own life, and we've seen the stress of Galliano. We've, and then we've seen so many of the designers move houses because the pressure from the CEO or whatever it is, you know, wanting more, or not being satisfied with what the designer's giving. So the pressure is enormous. And of course, the other thing is, it used to be just two seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to sell summer and, you know, spring and summer and autumn and winter. Now it's holiday and pre and, you know, we do four collections a year, but many other brands do six. And then a lot of the fast fashion guys do
the
literally
constant.
12, one yeah. a month, you know.
That's right.
And so you're on this treadmill, and in fashion, you've either got to be on it 100% or get off.
I want to know how you stay both sane and inventive, because you are a man, paradoxically, of habits and of constant rejuvenation. You wake up every morning, you take a swim.
Yeah.
Every time I've seen you, it doesn't matter what city, Paris, London, you ride your bike around.
Yeah.
So, but what do daily habits do for the creative mind? In some ways, you could say they work against rejuvenation, because it's also kind of, you know, it's habitual.
I mean, I am a creature of habit in terms I swim around 5 o'clock every morning. I get to work around 6 o'clock every morning. But I think the key, and this applies not just to people in our business, but especially for sports people. And I've got a lot of friends that are cyclists.
Yeah.
If they're stressed, they won't do the job properly. And there's a friend of mine who's been pretty stressed recently as a bike rider. And then last time I saw him win, I could tell from his face that he was relaxed. And when he's relaxed, he wins. When he's not relaxed for whatever reason, you know, something to do personal at home or not feeling great or I don't know what it is, you know. And so with me, I'm blessed with having security at home because I've been with Pauline since I was 21. So, you know, we have a really good understanding. I've learned to listen and talk, and I've learned to be interested and interesting. And walk in the door and not say what I've been doing, but ask what she's been doing, and getting the balance right of life, and understanding that friendship, love, and health is absolutely as important as cash, more important. Mm-hmm. And so, if you're relaxed, so it's not really a habit, a creature of habit. Although I do have those things, it's just the fact that. You know, we had a girl at work who complained that the problem with working at Portsmouth was she got stomachache with laughing. So I figured that was a pretty good
It could
complaint.
Be worse, yeah. Worse punishments yeah. of the office. Your office is designed in what I'm going to call it messy cool.
An Aladdin's cave.
It is. It's wild. It walks a fine line between maximalism and hoarding.
Yeah, that's right.
Parts of it look like an outsider art exhibition, but it is so cool. It's full of all these things that people have sent you in the mail.
Correct.
There's this one dude that has sent you all these things, like chairs with stamps on it or boards and, yeah. you know.
Amazing things like a chair or a ski, but they're never in a box. The stamps are actually on the actual article. And it's
and the
amazing.
The Postal Service still somehow gets it
yeah.
to you.
And also, what's the joy of it? Honestly, is the joy of it is there's no demand. In this right. greedy world and this world where everything's like, well, what do you want? You know, yeah. what's this about? You know, it's not about anything. It's just about doing something that's interesting or special. So he's absolutely correct. I mean, I'm not sure whether your listeners know who Dieter Rams is or if John Porson is, but yeah. Dieter Rams is like the purest minimalist designer of you know, clocks and you
he did
know
Brown, right?
Yeah, he did Brown. Yeah. Well, and then John Porson, who's the architect, who's designs the most minimal. Spaces you could ever see. They've both been to my room,
oh,
and
yeah?
neither of them had a heart attack. Miracle. I think the word they used was, "Oh, this is interesting." I think they were being polite.
Other rooms are actually surprisingly stark. You'll have a room that only has like a chair and a.
I mean, we've got a 4-5 floor building in London, yeah. and I'm on the top floor, and my room is absolutely full of things. But a lot of the things are sent. By fans around the world, which is incredibly humbling and lovely and special.
Yeah, but it's also sort of a window into that you can be inspired by everything because some yeah. of it is stuff. I know you go to vintage markets, Portobello Road, all that stuff,
yeah.
and you're constantly finding stuff. That stuff always finds its way into
into
your
the room, yeah.
right?
Yeah, I mean that there's one man who's been sending me, a gift from Japan. Mostly little rabbits, because you probably know the story.
I
once said rabbits were good luck for me, and now I get a very large quantity of them all the time. I should have said diamonds, obviously. I said rabbits, so stupid. Oh, and incidentally, anybody who's listening, I really love diamonds. I collect them. No, I'm joking. But this guy sends me a gift once a year, and they're all wrapped in that beautiful way, in the Japanese wrap, you know, where they wrap them in fabric and they knot them at the top.
Oh.
And they just sit on my, my table. And when you look at the pattern of each one and the pattern next to the pattern and the pattern next to the pattern and the colour next to that,
yeah.
and then immediately you look, oh, that could be an amazing trouser and that could be an amazing shirt. Put them together, it's even more interesting and it's fantastic. So a lot of people look at the room, maybe, I don't know, I've never had this said to me, but I think they look at it and say, oh, it's hoarding or it's childish or something. But for me, my opinion is that it's childlike because mm-hmm. And the difference is huge about
between childlike and childish.
Oh yeah, enormous. Because you know, it was Picasso said, for instance, he said, you know, I spent my life still wanting to paint like a child, because children are not cluttered with education or with experience. They're still very honest and open. You know, they and if you ask them to draw a cat, they would just do two pointed things at the top, a round face and some whiskers, and it would be a cat.
Yeah.
Sure, it would be a cat. You know, and so sometimes when I look in my room, I just think, why did anybody design that? You know, and then you start thinking, well, actually, it does feel amazing in your hand, or it's the colors together are fantastic. So a lot of people might see it as junk, and I see it as total inspiration.
You also you don't use a computer, and you don't have a desk.
No.
What's up with that? Is that
I have a desk
still?
Which I've never sat at.
You can't sit still, right?
Yeah. I'm not doing badly today.
Oh, no,
yeah.
I know.
Maybe it's that Scotch tape that to my legs to the chair.
But you don't need technology.
No, I mean, I have the iPhone, which I take pictures with most days, and obviously I've got a few pals that I text to, but I don't. Not hundreds at all. I don't have a computer. I don't have an email at all. But of course, literally around me, the company is completely modern in every, whatever the words are, high tech.
Well, there's just a hub of activity when you go there, and you're like literally running around from one room.
Yeah,
to the next, literally running.
Yeah, well, there's just under 200 of us in the building where I work, and so the communication is wonderful, because we're all in one building. So often the best ideas come when you're going to make a cup of tea or go to the loo or something, you know.
what about a few more things about your abiding influences? When you think about, you know, you did something for the BBC on Desert Island Music.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's changed since then, but what are the things that you just keep coming back to as inspirations?
Sometimes words, you know, people like, because I'm older guy, you know, so people like Van Morrison, mm-hmm. the way he puts words together, or Bob Dylan, then things like that. You know, somebody like Van Morrison, Astral Weeks album has taken me around the world on my own so many times. Yeah. And
it's still
Coney
as good
Island.
As it was. It's still as good as it ever was,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But you listen to a lot of new stuff too. I know you're always keeping up with stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, we dress loads of bands, and you know, work with a lot of young actors and actresses, and a lot of musicians. Luminaires from here, mm-hmm. from America, they like, you know, wear a lot of Paul Smith and Jake Bugg and English Lad.
Yeah,
So lots of bands. And then the more mature ones, like, you know, we had U2 in this week. They were in because they were playing in concert. So, you know, they get some clothes this week. And then we had, you know, the racing cyclist, Geraint Thomas, who won the Tour de France. He was in yesterday.
Oh, cool.
You know, so it's very varied, you know.
Yeah, you always have tons of visitors, right?
Yeah, really a lot, yeah.
And then what about movies? Are there any abiding, like, the stuff that you continually either are influenced by or say, I just can't get over how it was made?
Well, I'm a good pal of Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
I've known him for many, many years. And so all of his movies are really interesting because, well, for me, they're interesting because I was blessed with being with him when he was preparing for a lot of them. And he's a method actor, so he sort of lives the part. Some of those are sensational, but
including Phantom Thread.
Yes, of course. Yeah, well, he worked in our studio for a week in where we do the custom, where we do bespoke. So he worked with the boys who do the cutting for a week. But then
did he ask a ton of questions, or was he just an observer?
No, yes, loads of questions all the time. But we go back a long time. I've known him for really a long time.
Yes, and so I saw a picture of you in the, I think it was early '80s or something. When was that My Beautiful Laundrette, even, way back then?
Hanif Qureshi wrote Laundrette. Stephen Frears directed it, and Daniel was in it, and they're all mates of mine. So, in fact, I spoke to Hanif yesterday because his two sons were 25 yesterday. So he just sent me a picture of them because I'd forgotten that when Hanif Qureshi's sons were born, they're twins, I did a T-shirt with a picture of the kids on the T-shirt, and he's just framed it for them yesterday. And of course, we were all good mates with David Bowie.
Yeah.
And we had I had supper with Hanif and David one night, and we were just leaving the restaurant, and it was on the first floor. This restaurant, and as we, I was with Pauline, and as we walked down the stairs, David Bowie started singing, "The party's over and we can call it a day." And I was like, "My God, that's David Bowie singing to Pauline and I." It was so special.
I always thought he was the perfect embodiment of your spirit, because he's not he wasn't you know, assuming, he wasn't an ego, and he was also just.
When he came to the to my room where you've been, you know, with which is full of all this stuff, he just couldn't stop asking questions. Where's that from? Where's that from? What's that book about? Where did you get that from? And he's got this lovely, lovely, curious mind all the time, you know, really wouldn't stop asking, what's that about? You know, and that's why his songs and his persona and his chameleon sort of way existed, because he was always ready for the next thing and turning into something different.
When you think about the world of Paul Smith, and it has expanded into so many categories and fields and collaborations, how do you know whether it's gonna work for you or it's too much? What's the, you know, is if someone comes to you with a car collaboration, what's the criterion?
Rather rude, the answer. He said, yeah. Do I ever want to meet this man again? Yes, like, yes. Yeah. No, okay, I won't do it.
So it's just a vibe you get.
I mean, we say no to far more than we say yes to. And yeah. It's normally just completely about instinct. And, you know, I've been asked to do lots of cars, for instance, but I've
I did
the little Mini, yeah,
so cool.
And that was just a bit of fun, and it was just a one-off, you know. But we get asked to do lots, hotels, a lot of hotels, restaurants. But to be honest, I just think, why would I do this? And they say, oh, well, you can earn £3 million by, and I say, well, I don't really want to give up my time for doing something that I'm not really, you know, going to think is wonderful or enjoy, you know. It's not, life's too short, you know.
I think that's a great note to end on, because one of the things you said was that you weren't after more money. You were just, when you got into fashion, you said something like, I just wanted to have a happy day, a good day or something, right?
Yeah, we just want to have a nice day, yeah. We're on the earth for such a short time, and, you know, health, love, friendship, and a nice interview, that'll do me.
Hey, thanks for listening to Mad Influence. We'll be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks. And if you liked what you heard, leave us a review or a comment on iTunes or on whatever platform you use to listen. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.